This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Good morning, and welcome to Power of Attorney, a 30-minute educational program focused on legal developments affecting individuals and businesses. Power of Attorney is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm with more than 50 attorneys located in Reston, Virginia, serving clients in the D.C. metro area and across the country. You can learn more about Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman on the web at www.ofplaw.com or by calling us at 703-218-2100. I'm David Zangrilli, your host for the next 4 weeks. And for those of you who don't know me, I practice exclusively in Virginia in the area of family law, or what some people call domestic relations. So I represent spouses going through a divorce, I draft prenuptial agreements for people about to get married, and I handle child custody and visitation cases and child support cases for parents who have children but were never married. For the first half of today's show, I'm going to demystify the process of filing a divorce case in the courts, discussing the mechanics and the procedures. During the second half of today's show, I'm excited to welcome attorney Gia Shepherdson as our special guest. Gia is of counsel to the law firm of Rissmiller Law Group, LLC, in Rockville, Maryland. The firm's main practice areas are family law, with a niche in cases involving some element of domestic abuse, and criminal law. Gia's primary practice is family law, with a specific focus on representing children in complex custody cases. She has been appointed in over 90 cases to represent the needs of children during a custody dispute, and she is also an adjunct law professor at Stevenson University. Okay, so let's talk about the mechanics and procedures of filing a divorce. When clients walk into my office for an initial consultation, they're often shocked to discover just how long it takes to obtain a divorce. The divorce process is grueling. It can really beat you down. Clients are under a tremendous amount of stress when they're going through a divorce. I've seen people gain weight, lose weight. Many of my clients see psychologists and psychiatrists. It really is a survival of the fittest, as Darwin said. Many people during this process have a girlfriend or they have a boyfriend, and they really just want to move on and start a new life, and they can't wait to get out of their current marriage. So, you want to get divorced. What can you expect? How do you go about getting a divorce in Virginia? First, one of the spouses, just one, needs to be both a resident and a domiciliary of Virginia for 6 months. So you can't just move to Virginia and 2 weeks later file for divorce. You have to be both a resident, which means that you're physically present here in Virginia. That's easy enough. If you live here, you're a resident. And you have to be what we call a domiciliary, meaning that it's your intention to remain living here in Virginia for some unknown length of time. If you knew that a month down the road you're going to be, you know, moving out of Virginia to North Carolina, say, then you're not technically a domiciliary. So as long as one of the spouses is both a resident and domiciliary, you can file for the divorce here in Virginia. Second, you need to be able to allege grounds for divorce. There's what we call fault grounds and no fault grounds. The fault grounds are, number one, adultery, number two, cruelty, and number three, desertion or abandonment. Those fault grounds are really a topic for another day and are a whole show unto themselves. The no-fault ground is simply living separately and apart from your husband or wife for the requisite period of time. So what is the requisite period of time? If the husband and wife sign what we often call a property settlement agreement, which resolves all of their issues in their case, and it's called a PSA, a property settlement agreement, but it addresses other issues besides just property. It can cover child support, spousal support, custody, visitation, pretty much everything. If the husband and wife sign a property settlement agreement, and if they don't have children, then they can get divorced after they've been separated for just 6 months. If, however, they have children, even if they sign a property settlement agreement, they have to wait 1 year from the date of separation. If they're alleging adultery, you can actually file the divorce case immediately. So if you find out that your spouse is cheating, you can file the divorce the next day. There's no separation requirement. Now, that being said, technically you can actually obtain a divorce immediately, but that's not the way it works. practically, because of the huge dockets that the local courts have, you're not going to have a trial date for easily 6 months, but probably closer to 12 months. So in effect, it's going to be a long waiting period anyways. If you're alleging one of the other fault grounds, desertion or cruelty, you can file the divorce case immediately. You don't have to wait. You can file it immediately, but you still have to wait 1 year before the divorce can be final. Now, if you're alleging just a simple no-fault ground of being separated for 1 year, you can't even file the case with the court until you've been separated for 1 year. So, for example, let's say husband and wife split up tomorrow, and they're not able to reach an agreement. They can't sign a PSA. And they have to go to trial and let a judge decide property and custody and visitation and support and all the other stuff. They're not going to be divorced for approximately 2 years. That's right, 2 years. That's a long period of time. And that is a very tough pill for people to swallow because they just want to get on with their lives. They want to move on. They don't want to spend the next 2 years, you know, embroiled in a bitter divorce case, which not only costs a tremendous amount of money, but creates a lot of bad blood with your ex, which, you know, if you have children, it's not a great way to be starting the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years of your life where your spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse hates you. All right, so what does it take to be separated? You have to be separated for that clock to start ticking so that you can, you know, be separated for 1 year. To be separated under Virginia law, two things need to coincide. Number one, you need to have physical separation. Number two, one of the spouses, just one, needs to form the intention in their mind that they want a divorce. You know, that's it. I want a divorce. I'm done. When those two things coincide, then that's the date of separation. So let's talk about the physical separation piece of this first. You know, the obvious example is when wife moves out of the house, and that's you know, a physical separation. It is possible under Virginia law to be separated in the same house. Now, I've heard judges lecture about this issue, and there's judges in many parts of Virginia that will not grant a divorce if the parties were living in the same house. They just simply, you know, for matters of public policy, find it hard to believe that a husband and wife can truly be separated while they're still living in the same house. In Northern Virginia, I have not experienced that to be a problem. All of the local jurisdictions will grant a divorce if the parties are indeed living separately in the same house. And in the last few years, you know, when the economy really took a turn for the worse, we saw more and more of this because one spouse or the other just simply could not afford to move out and get a place of his or her own. It was just way too expensive. So you had the parties living together trying to weather the storm for as long as they possibly could. Now, clients always ask me, you know, what does it take to be separated within the same house? There's no magic list. There's certain, you know, things that we advise our clients not to do, because the more of those things that you do, the more it looks like you're not separated. So I advise all of my clients, you know, obviously you sleep in separate bedrooms. You don't have sexual relations. You don't share a bathroom. You don't buy groceries for your spouse. You don't make your spouse dinner. You don't sit on the couch and watch TV with your spouse. You don't go places together. You don't get in the car and go see your kid's, you know, soccer game. You drive separately. You take off your wedding ring. You tell your family and your friends that, oh yeah, we're separated. So the more of those things you can do, the more it makes it look like you truly are separated. It can be very, very difficult to live separately in the house if you have kids. You know, a lot of you listeners have probably seen the old movie with Michael Douglas, War of the Roses, where they essentially paint a line down the middle of the house and wife is supposed to be on one side and husband is supposed to be on the other. When you have kids, you can't do that, obviously. It can create a tremendous amount of stress on the children. You know, when mommy and daddy aren't talking to each other, when they're passing each other like ships in the night, you know, and they're fighting over, well, you know, it's my time to spend time with little Joey. You can't spend time with him. It's really a bad situation for kids. But it happens. It happens all the time where mom or dad will move down into the, you know, the basement, the bedroom in the basement, and kind of do their own thing. So that's the first prong of the test of what it takes to be separated. The second prong, as I mentioned earlier, is the intention. Now, oftentimes, the physical separation and the intention don't coincide. You'll have, you know, one party or the other, husband or wife, move out of the house. And it's kind of a, you know, a trial and error period. They're not really sure. You know, they think they want to get a divorce, but they're not 100% sure. So they move out and, you know, they move out and they got their own place and they're starting to go out and go to happy hour and hang out and do things that they couldn't do when they were married. And they realize, you know what, this is better than being married. And 3 months later, they say, you know, that's it. I'm done. I want to get a divorce. Well, that's the date of the separation. when those two things finally coincide, the physical separation and the intention. All right. So how do you prove? How do you prove to the judge that you've been separated for 1 year? People ask me this all the time. Well, I assume I need a contract or a writing or a quote-unquote separation agreement. And that's just not true. Under Virginia law, you don't need anything in writing to prove that you're separated. You don't even need to have sent your husband or wife a text or an email saying, hey, for the record, we're separated. It's a pure factual question. You're either separated or you're not. The tricky part is that Virginia is, as most of you probably know, fairly old school in its thinking. And Virginia law is pro-marriage. And, obviously, with the one-year separation requirement, they wanted to make sure people are serious about getting divorced before they rush off and do it. So they want to make sure that husband and wife are not conspiring to get a divorce. That husband and wife say, okay, we just broke up yesterday, and, let's just hurry up and get a divorce, so let's lie. Let's lie and say we were separated a year ago. So Virginia tries to guard against that. So what they do is they require that you have a third-party witness, someone to corroborate the fact that you have been living separately. So normally you have a friend or a relative or a neighbor, someone who's been inside your home at least a handful of times during the prior year, who can testify that, your wife wasn't in the house, her stuff wasn't there, she was never in the house, and it clearly appeared that you were living separately. And that person will testify and tell the court that you also formed the intention to get a divorce a year ago. And you ask them, well, how do you know that? How do you know, Mr. Smith formed that intention? And they say, well, because I talked to him and he told me. I talked to him a year ago and he said, you know what, Joe, I'm done. I want a divorce. That's it. Now, when you have parents living separately and apart in the same house, the problem is most parents don't have that witness. They don't have anybody who can corroborate that. They don't have friends and neighbors coming into the house on a regular basis when it's World War III in the house. So that's usually the big issue, is that they don't have anyone to corroborate that. So assuming you have grounds, then you can file for a divorce with the court. You file a document called the complaint, which alleges all the necessary facts, your date of marriage, your kids, their ages, all that kind of stuff. Then you get your spouse served by a private process server or a sheriff, and then you're off to the races. We're going to take a short break now, but please stay with us. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and you've been listening to Power of Attorney, hosted by Odin Feldman and Pittleman. To learn more about Odin Feldman and Pittleman, find us on the web at www.ofplaw.com or call us at 703-218-2100.
You're listening to Power of Attorney with the attorneys from Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Learn more about legal developments affecting individuals and businesses when Power of Attorney returns in a moment.
Hi, I'm John Frieden with your Legal Minute. Successful e-commerce businesses invest a great deal of time, effort, and money developing their websites. Though these websites may be among their most valuable assets, e-commerce businesses rarely think to fully protect them. A successful e-commerce business is likely to attract imitators who liberally borrow website content to drive their own sales. In too many instances, an e-commerce market leader finds itself suddenly beset by competitors who have been able to implement their websites quickly and easily by using content taken from the market leader. An e-commerce business can protect the original content of its website and reduce the risk of loss associated with this sort of imitation by archiving the website regularly so that the website owner can demonstrate exactly what was on the website at each particular point in time, and obtaining a United States and foreign copyright registrations of appropriate material. For more information on this topic, go to powerofattorneyradio.com and click on Legal Minute.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney on 1500 AM. I'm David Zangrilli, and with me is my special guest, Attorney Gia Shepherdson. Gia is of counsel to the law firm of Rissmiller Law Group, LLC, in Rockville, Maryland. The firm's main practice areas are family law, with a niche in cases involving some element of domestic abuse, and criminal law. Gia's primary practice is family law, with a specific focus on representing children in complex custody cases. She has been appointed in over 90 cases to represent the needs of children during a custody dispute, and she is also an adjunct law professor at Stevenson University. Good morning, Gia.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for being on. So tell us, what is a quote-unquote best interest attorney?
Well, most people think of the best interest attorney's role as a guardian ad litem, and that's what actually what we were previously called in Maryland, and it's what we're called in many other states. But Maryland, in about 2006, changed over to calling us best interest attorneys, and also defining other types of attorneys that can represent children in custody disputes. But basically, the best interest attorney is someone who is appointed by a court to represent a child in a complex or disputed custody case. To represent the best interest of the child, the need of the child, sometimes the voice of the child, and to represent the interest, whether or not they're consistent with the child's desires.
And it sounds similar to what we do call still in Virginia guardian ad litem.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned best interest. Is that kind of the general standard that judges look at to determine whether a dad or mom should have custody?
Yep. The best interest standard is, from what I understand, is the standard in most cases, in most states, to determine what the appropriate custody, visitation, and other types of related issues, what those will be.
And I'm going to call them BIA. Are BIAs appointed in every case in which custody or visitation is at issue?
No, certainly not. A lot of custody cases end up also being somewhat amicable, if I dare to say that,
right.
And sometimes can settle on their own without the necessity of services like a custody evaluator or a BIA. But in cases where it is necessary, they usually fall into two categories, I think of. The first category is where the child might be old enough to have input as to his or her custody schedule or access schedule or whatever the case may be, provided that child is mature enough and has considered judgment in order to have input in a case like that. And then the other category is what I always refer to myself as a complex custody case, which would include some element maybe of or some tough issue. For example, domestic abuse, substance abuse by an adult or a child, a mental health concern of an adult or a child, or even just being a very high conflict case in which the parties can't agree as to whether the sky is blue. And of course, there's some pour over to the child
right.
for that.
You mentioned the first category of cases when the child may be old enough or mature enough to express an opinion as to his or her custodial arrangement. Under Maryland law, is there a magic age where the judges say, okay, this child's old enough, but this child's not old enough?
There's actually not a magic age. It really has to be sort of a totality of the circumstances. Is the child of some sort of appropriate age combined with their maturity, and are they making their opinions or decisions about themselves using reasonable and appropriate judgment?
Right. It is a difficult issue. In cases I've had in Virginia, most judges are of the opinion that if a parent really wants to call a child to testify, then they're going to let them. Now, oftentimes the judges will try to strong arm the parents and say, you know, are you sure? Are you sure you really want to call this child to the witness stand? But unless the child's 3 years old, for example, I mean, most judges are going to let the child testify. And the only real question is how much weight to give to their testimony based on their age and their maturity and their experience.
Sure. In my experience, I primarily practice in Montgomery County and Montgomery County, Maryland. And that circuit court is the judges there I find are really, really hesitant to let the children testify, as you've said. And the testimony can be done in a number of different ways. It can be done on the stand, which is obviously the least desirable method to do that. It can also be done in the courtroom, but the courtroom is cleared and the judge is just talking to the child alone there, whether or not it's recorded. Or it could even be done in judges' chambers, again, whether or not it's recorded. As the best interest attorney, sometimes I will accompany the child when they're doing that testimony and maybe be the only person with the child because the child might feel comfortable having at least someone there with them. But then at the end of the day, the judges really decide based on what the child has to say and makes a decision sort of him or herself in that moment as to whether the child does have the considered judgment and is making appropriate decisions for themselves and weighs that against the other evidence and testimony in the trial.
And describe, if you would, the type of investigation, the things you do when you're appointed as a best interest attorney.
It really depends on the case. The case and the facts of it will dictate how extensive the investigation will be. But generally, when I'm first appointed, I'll speak with each of the attorneys. If the parents are represented by attorneys, I'll meet with each of the parents I meet with the child generally at each of the households, if it's appropriate in that case. And then I will speak to the relevant professionals in the child's life, the teachers, the guidance counselors, doctors, therapists, sometimes coaches, if there's a sport or something like that in which the child is very deeply involved. But it's really dictated by the case as to how extensive that investigation is.
And like mom's lawyer or dad's lawyer, are you allowed to issue subpoenas for, you know, relevant records and take people's depositions if you need to?
Yes, people are often surprised by this. Usually the parents in the case are surprised with actually how extensive the best interest attorney's role is with respect to the litigation procedure. We subpoena witnesses, we subpoena records if we need to. We do note depositions. We can participate in all aspects of discovery. The good news is usually when we're first appointed and before we've given our position to anyone in the case, most people will cooperate with us and provide us a lot of the information without the necessity of some of these more litigious tools. But we do have it available to us. And oftentimes with something like a deposition, one of the parents' attorneys will note a deposition. And so I would still, or the best interest attorney would still attend that deposition, participate in the questioning to try and reduce doubling efforts or doubling costs for the parents.
Right, sure. And how, during the course of your role, how many times do you normally meet with the child? Is it just one or is it more than one?
This one also really depends on the case. It depends on the child. So, for example, if there's a 16-year-old child who has very strong opinions about the custody matters, it could be beneficial to that child for me to meet with them several times. At the same time, meeting with them several times could end up causing more anxiety for that child. So that's a good reason for me to stay in heavy contact with the therapist and determine to get information from the therapist that I can also get from the therapist and to make sure that the child is doing okay. But then if you have a child who is, for example, 2 years old, there's not very much information that I would be getting from the child. There's not a whole lot of input that the child could be giving me. And sometimes the contact with me might not be so good because it might be creating problems or anxiety where there wasn't something like that before.
Sure. And do you find I've had plenty of cases where in Virginia I had a guardian ad litem in the case, and I always try to be as nice and as sweet to the GAL as possible because I want them to like me. I want them to like my client. I usually spend some time at the very beginning of the case giving them a rundown of you know, all the positives about my client and the negatives about the other client. Do you experience that the mom and dads, their lawyers, are really bending over backwards to try to be nice to you?
For the most part, I have been very lucky to be appointed in cases with some very pleasant attorneys, and it makes the whole thing so much easier and so much better for the child at the end of the day, because mom's attorney really only hears mom's side of the case. Dad's attorney only really hears dad's side of the case. Sometimes the best interest attorney can, you know, really get the neutral part and really what's really best for the child. And it's nice when you're working with attorneys who will trust your professional opinion and trust what you have to say, whether or not it's consistent with their client. So most of the time, it is a very pleasant experience. Sometimes after I give my position in the case, it's not always as pleasant, unfortunately. But everybody has a job to do and a client to protect.
I certainly understand that. Oftentimes, the BIA or the guardian ad litem becomes public enemy number one once the attorney gives their position as, mm-hmm. and their opinion as to who should have custody and you know, which parent should have visitation.
Mm-hmm. So, sometimes I felt that if I've made an enemy of everybody, it means that I'm doing my job because I'm only out there to represent what's good for the child and not
exactly
for anyone
right.
else.
Now, when you're actually in trial, are you allowed to give your opinions to the judge or do you really just serve a role as if you're just another attorney in the courtroom?
Well, it's kind of both. So the best interest attorney, just like participating in subpoenas and depositions and things like that, plaintiff presents their case, defendant presents their case, and then there's a third segment of the case where the best interest attorney does the same exact thing. So the best interest attorney does have a position, just like mom's attorney would have a position, just like dad's attorney would have a position. It's made very clear through opening arguments, through the evidence that we present, opening statements through our evidence and then our closing arguments. And my practice is usually at the very beginning to bring a proposed order to the judge. So the judge knows exactly what it is that I'm asking for on behalf of my child client.
So you're not essentially you're not acting as a witness where you're not testifying in court, but you're able to call your own witnesses, ask them questions, and cross-examine other witnesses who are testifying.
That's right. When Maryland had guardian ad litems, they would testify or submit a written report or something like that. Since it's crossed over to being best interest attorneys, and there are other types of attorneys that have similar roles, there are no more written reports that we submit to the court, except in the case that we might be waiving the child's therapeutic privilege or not. But that's a very simple one-page report.
Okay.
And we certainly do not testify. The orders appointing us actually specifically say that we are not to be testifying in the custody proceedings.
Now, that being said, prior to the actual trial, do you still inform mom's lawyer and dad's lawyer as to what your opinions are?
Yes, I actually try to do that as soon as possible after I get appointed. So when I'm appointed, provided that that I can do it, I dive right into the case and I try and get to the bottom of things very quickly. And then I'll contact the attorneys or the parties if they're pro se, not represented by counsel. And I let them know what my position is so that we can either try and settle the case or at least begin settlement negotiations. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be best to try and settle the case. If nothing else, it pulls that anxiety that's happening in the households off the plate of the child.
And do you find, in my experience, once in Virginia, the guardian ad litem gives his or her opinion, the vast majority of the time, cases settle because the lawyers say, well, if it's going to be obvious to the judge what the GAL's opinion is, and the judges really rely heavily on the GAL. So do you find that as well in Maryland, that once you let the attorneys know that most of those cases settle?
Definitely. And I'm very pleased by that most of the time we are able to settle the case.
And in the cases when you're not able to settle the case, in your experience, what percentage of cases do the judges really rule in line with your position?
Well, I wish it was 100%.
Right, sure, we all do, right?
Because I've come up with this opinion for a reason. But I have to say, I feel lucky that most of the time the judges have ruled with something at least very close to what my position is in the case. Sometimes there are some variations, albeit they're usually small. At the end of the day, though, even when they have been larger variations from what I've requested, I've never been devastated by what's happened in court. I don't know if it's luck or whatever the case may be. I've always felt walking out of the courtroom that the judge really did get it right, whether it's exactly with what I've asked for, something close to it, or something a little bit further away.
Well, that's great to hear. Gia, thanks so much for coming on the show today. If our listeners have any questions about any of these issues, how can they contact you?
Thank you, David. I would love for anybody to contact us if we have any questions. They can reach us at our office at Rissmiller Law Group at 301-340-1616, or can always access through our website at www.rissmillerlawgroup.com.
And if our listeners are interested in these issues or any related issues, please visit Odin Feldman and Pittleman's family law blog at virginiadivorceandcustodylaw.com, or you can email me at david.zangrilli@ofplaw.com. Thank you for listening. Please make Power of Attorney a regular part of your Saturday morning and check out our website at www.powerofattorneyradio.com. Next week, my special guest is attorney Donna Rissmiller, who will be discussing a very serious topic of domestic violence, which you won't want to miss. Have a great week, and we look forward to talking with you next Saturday.
You've been listening to Power of Attorney with Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Power of Attorney will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. right here on 1500 AM.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of of Federal Community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.